Hello, it's me, Danny Parkinson. Welcome along to the Daytimes podcast. Well, if you missed any of it this week, we've got a massive podcast coming your way. We're going to be talking about Jamie Peacock. Of course, he went from, retirement to playing again for Hull KR. So we're going to be hearing from Phil Kaplan, a Rhinos historian, an all-round knower of everything Leeds Rhinos. He's going to give us his thoughts on it, and a real rugby league connoisseur he is. Greg White, former Olympian, joins us to talk about some nutrition. Alan Birkinshaw from the TNA cricket correspondent, he joins us to talk all about Yorkshire cricket. Also talk Future Fest with Pat Kane from Hue and Cry. Yeah, I didn't even realise at the time. Well, I did, halfway through the interview. We'll also got that debate with Liam from the Mirror Online on whether or not... it should be a debate on who is the best players from Manchester United's team putting a lineup. Turned out to be an argument about 4-4-2 or 4-2-3-1. And we'll also be hearing from Ian Barraclough as well. All that and much, much more coming up on the Daytimes. But first, let's just look at Doncaster Rovers, because they've been in action. It just depends on when you're listening to this. Against Morecambe in a third kit that's for charity. It's a fantastic idea. Looks absolutely brilliant. I was talking to their COO, Liam Scully, all about this.
Hi, no problem.
I've got to start by talking about this kit. It's a fairly novel solution to this kit clash problem. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose it's standard practice at every football club, really. But at the start of the season, we have a look at the new kits that get sent through from the Football League. And basically, upon looking through the kit permutations for the seasons, we pretty quickly realised that the Morecambe kit is pretty much a hybrid of ours, both home and away. So with that, I think there's been some novel solutions in the past. But for us, as a club that's kind of integral to kind of charity partnerships, have a look at the wider offer within our community. What we wanted to do was something that wasn't kind of viewed as a commercial driver in terms of introducing a third strip, but something that could actually do a bit of good from this opportunity. So working with our charity partners, which is British Heart Foundation, we've kind of co-designed and come up with a strip that will be basically worn off as a one-off, and hopefully it gets us out of this kit clash problem, really.
Oh, it's absolutely brilliant. I love the strip as well. There, you can see that it is there for the British Heart Foundation as well. Is it all about raising awareness, but also being able to auction this off as well and being able to raise some money as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So, our plan really is first of all to raise awareness and hopefully, obviously, with working with British Heart Foundation, getting the coverage that this hopefully should go on to do, it will do that. But outside of that, we will be auctioning off the playing shirts that are worn on the day. And this, the proceeds of which will go directly to British Heart Foundation.
It's great as well that it's actually getting the exposure there as well for the charity, because obviously football's a massive medium now and everybody's going to be seeing it. All eyes are going to be on the British Heart Foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, ourselves at Doncaster Rovers, we've had some kind of unfortunate history with incidents that have happened within the stadium or at football matches ourselves. So British Heart Foundation is not only a charity that is chosen by the fans because of the obvious reasons that come to that, but it's also someone that we're keen to work with over a prolonged period of time to further both their aims and obviously tackling much needed concerns in terms of heart disease and heart attacks, and anything we can do to help is great, really.
The fact that he's going to be such a big game against Morecambe as well, because Captain James Coppinger making his 500 appearances for the Rovers. I mean, I can't even say it's that much of a good achievement, Liam.
Yeah, James has been a real role model for the young people of Doncaster, and he's been a great servant. So it's going to be nice all round. James is his 500th game. The charity partnership, and hopefully, for ourselves, selfishly, we come away with the 3 points.
And just looking at that, I was talking to one of the former Donny legends, Richie Wellens, not so long ago, Liam, and he was talking about the midfielder Coppinger. He's been there through some great times for Donny, really, hasn't he? I mean, you look back to the winning of the playoff final against Leeds United a few years ago. Now he's really seen it all with Doncaster.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned the highs that we've had there, but I think it's also probably worthwhile recognising, James has been a real club man, and through the various different highs and lows, You know, he's somebody that's absolutely given his all for the club and stuck by us. So this milestone for us is great to see. It's becoming more of a rare thing in modern day football. But no, James is a real club legend and a word that's often maybe misused or overused. But James is absolutely one of those for Doncaster Rovers, and really looking forward to celebrating it with him.
And looking ahead to this weekend, Morecambe obviously up next. A side that have surprised a lot of people, second in the league at the moment. It's going to be a tough game, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I think most importantly for ourselves, you know, there's a lot going on and around the day. There's obviously the shirt that we've discussed. There's James's 500th appearance, but importantly for us, you know, it's a competitive league fixture, and it's got to be something that we come away with something from the game. Our away following this year has been absolutely phenomenal. As has been our home following. So, you know, important for the day that the fans that do back us and travel with us are you know, entertained and come away with what they expect, which, you know, frankly, put us 3 points.
Yeah, absolutely no doubt about that. And after six games up and around the right part of the table, we're hoping for more of that similar things throughout the season.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the owners and Darren have been quite clear in every bit of communication that's come out of the club. You know, the expectation is promotion this year and nothing else. So, you know, home games, away games, you know, like the one that's coming up this weekend, it's absolutely important to keep the momentum, or to get the momentum going that we had from the early season and go from there and build.
Absolutely no doubt about that. And how has the club come together since last year's relegation, Liam? Is it stronger for it?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think probably, you know, my favourite conversation I usually have in the close season is everybody who doesn't work within football kind of presumes that we all get on the sun lounger and kind of put us feet up. It's certainly not that. You know, it was a period of reflection, trying to understand every element of the club and what we needed to do to be better. And ultimately, what's come of that is, you know, out of adversity, I suppose you always come out the other side a little bit stronger. So for myself and certainly for my role with looking at the off-the-field stuff, it's really pleasing that we've come together. And I suppose things like the third kit are examples of this. You know, the effort that's gone in from our kit partner, from the commercial team, from the media team, just to get this turned around in such a short space of time really, really shows the kind of what we'd like to think the Premier League infrastructure that's off the pitch.
That's exactly what I was just going to say, Liam. Just finally, on Doncaster Rovers, because it do seem to have the fan base and the facilities, everything of a League One sort of championship club. So is everyone really hoping that this season they can just first time and bounce back straight to to League One again?
Yeah, absolutely. That's got to be the expectation. And you know, fortunately, you know, we've managed to keep the infrastructure behind the scenes of a League One championship club. And that's important, really, that, you know, that we've got, you know, once we, you know, arrive at those destinations, that we don't have to rebuild the club. You know, off the field, we've got absolutely everything there to set us up for success. Obviously, we all know it's the green rectangle and the 90 minutes on the Saturday that makes the difference. But off the field, we're doing everything we can to make sure that we support the players, Darren, and the playing staff.
Well, so looking forward to this weekend, looking forward to Doncaster for the rest of the season as well. Liam, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for joining us here on Radio Yorkshire.
Thank you very much.
Doncaster COO Liam Scully there speaking to me about everything Doncaster. A really interesting chat there. But it wasn't just the world of football where interesting things were happening. We also had to look to the world of a rugby league as well, as Jamie Peacock moved from being retired over to being a player once again. And Hull KR in a very tricky situation at the moment. Could see themselves in the £1 million game with the coach for them next season in the opposite dugout. It's all a bit strange. Let's just keep it to Jamie Peacock. I spoke to Phil Kaplan, 40-20 editor, earlier this week.
Yes and no. Yes, because I thought that it would be fitting for him to go out on the finest possible stage, and there could be no greater fairy tale than Old Trafford and the three amigos arm in arm, riding off into the sunset, having achieved everything. And you would have thought that personally and professionally he wouldn't want to tarnish that image. But then, you know, 12 months down the line, you look at the state that Hull KR are in, trying to preserve their Super League status, and all the things that are happening around the club at the moment as regards players not being available for one reason or another. And I'm guessing that because he thinks even his livelihood might be at stake if they were to go down, that the only thing he can do is to lace up the new boots and try and do it one more time.
And that's just what I wanted to pick up on there, because there's been some comments from some Leeds Rhinos fans that I've seen that have called and saying, well, he didn't come to our crisis during the season. Is that a bit unfair, really, a bit harsh? Because it seems like it's two different types of crisis between what was at Leeds and now at Hull KR.
I suspect that his time at Leeds ended when the Super League trophy was put down next to the other two, and his job as a player at Leeds finished. He made the, I think, correct career decision to move in another direction, to try his hand at being a director of rugby and instilling the culture that he was such a part of at Leeds in the dressing room at Hull KR. That was the next challenge for him. His body was absolutely broken at the end of last year as well. I think what people may forget is that, you know, for almost 6 years, Leeds barely missed a round of rugby with the success that they had. And the age that he went on to, 37, that's just ridiculously astonishing. And the stats that he was producing in the final games of his career put him up there with the very, very best. But it took an enormous toll. And again, I'm not surprised that it's a year since he took his boots off and he's putting them on again. He may not have the aerobic capacity straight away, but I reckon he would have needed at least a year of healing for all the scars that he'd put into those astonishing performances, those you know, leave nothing left on the pitch performances that he did for Bradford and Leeds and his country.
That's something I wanted to pick up on there, Phil, because he's 38 years old now. I mean, what can we be expecting from Hull KR? Is it all about those leadership qualities, or will he still be adding something to that forward pack?
I think it's entirely about leadership. I think you can talk as much as you like and try and instill in people in lecture theatre situations and in dressing rooms before they go out exactly what you expect of them and how you think they may be able to achieve the common goal. But actually, there's nothing quite like having a guy at the front of that showing you how it's done. Hull KR have got some great youngsters coming through, and I have seen some debates about, you know, this is an insult to their youth policy. It actually isn't. If they got relegated, that would probably be the end of their youth policy. But in kids like Matty Marsh, who is a real prospect at halfback, George Lawler, who they've been in great faith in as a hooker, at this stage in their career, it's unfair and unrealistic to expect them to save Hull KR from potential relegation. They're barely into the start of their Super League careers. Nobody could have scripted over at New Craven Park the fact that certainly they would lose Terry Campese for the bulk of the season, who is their genuine leader. You've now got all the issues surrounding Albert Kelly, and again, I think to take a principled stance and say, you know, we're not going to include him. All of this part of the season is about unity and closeness and relying on your mate and being together. All of that kind of thing is undermined when a player doesn't come back when he should do. So I think you take him out of the equation. I also think Ken Seo was a massive influence for them. He's had a great season, just such a powerful runner at the back. He's now gone. And no coincidence, I think, that when he went off against Lee, that the ship began to tilt a little bit. So where do you turn to? You've actually got within your organisation the guy who is acknowledged by his contemporaries as arguably the finest foot soldier of his generation.
Phil Kaplan there, the 40-20 editor. Seems to be everything about Jamie Peacock. And we also had Greg White on, former Olympian and professional expert in fitness. He joined us for National Fitness Day earlier on this week. Very interesting chat indeed.
Well, I hope so is the answer to that. I mean, I think, you know, we have got a very long way to go. I mean, you know, sadly, we are the least active population in Europe. And that sort of really tells you a story about what we need in terms of moving forward. And I think definitely technology, particularly things around wearable tech and virtual trainers and those type of things, I think is one of the ways in which we're going to start to see improvements in engagement in activity and actually getting people moving more.
And what's the most exciting thing that you're looking at in the next 10 years?
But, you know, I think we've sort of already started it, really, and I think it's probably around the wearable tech area. We all know somebody. If we haven't got wearable tech ourselves, we all know somebody who has got it. So things like Fitbit, for example, you know, which is tracking what we're doing, not only actually tracking our activity, but tracking things like sleep. We can also integrate our diet and our nutrition within that as well. So I think for me, it's the sort of the easy access, the probably the lower end of the market in terms of the cost, which I think is going to have the greatest effect. And I think we're already starting to see that. And I think with the evolving technology and the sort of driving down of price of that, I think what we're going to start to see is an expansion across that, across the whole of society.
And do you think it's also a little bit about time as well? Do you think that'll be something that improves in the future? Because, you know, we all know about gym passes that are offered by some employers on site, so you're not having to go out to the gym and all the rest of it too far away from where you're living. Greg, is that something we might be seeing improvement in the future?
Interesting enough, today is National Fitness Day, and Argos, who are the lead sponsors on that, are actually giving away free gym passes at their stores around your area. So to some extent, you know, they're sort of leading the way in that area. I think that, you know, the thing to think about is that it's about finding what works for you. I think physical activity is a very personal thing. You know, we often talk about things like time, but it's actually integrating that activity into your daily living. You know, it's not just about, you know, putting on the spandex and sweating up in a gym. You know, it is about things like taking the stairs instead of the lift. It's about walking to work. You know, if you possibly can walk to work, it's standing up and sitting down more when you are at work. It's all of those type of things that are going to accumulate and make a really big difference.
Now, as we know, earlier this week, Root and Bairstow were left out of the Yorkshire County cricket side. Well, not left out, they couldn't be chosen, which seemed very, very strange at the time to a lot of people. I wanted to make head or tail of it. And talk about Jason Gillespie as well, with him leaving the Yorkshire cricketed setup. And just ask Alan Birkinshaw from the Telegraph and Argus, you know, can Yorkshire win a third title, and what would it mean to the county?
Of course it's going to be. I mean, who wouldn't miss players of the quality of Joe Root and Johnny Bairstow and all the things that they've achieved this year? But I think then you've also got to look and say, well, look at the other players that have come into the side and the roles that they've played under Andrew Gough's captaincy, and they've really done well. I mean, I think particularly this year, if you look at the side, I think one player for me that stood out and have been very impressed with his performances has been Tim Bresnan. And I think the number of times that he's come through and produced performances both with bat and ball, it's fantastic. And I think this is the team spirit and the ethic in the bench. The Yorkshire winning can become infectious, and I'm certain that that's something that's been encouraged through the great coaching team that they have.
And just looking at the upcoming fixtures as well, Durham and Somerset over at Headingley to come as well. Two very important games with everything that's going to be happening with the county championship. What can we expect from these two games? Are these winnable games for Yorkshire?
I would say every game is winnable for Yorkshire for the way that they play their cricket. They're a team that set high standards for themselves. You only have to watch them when they're performing. Even if they've got a low score to defend, the bowlers come out and do the business for them. I think they're very much winnable games. I think, you know, the championship is there to be won, and Yorkshire are a team that can see the finishing line. They know what they've got to do. They've been there before. And I think that's going to be the key over these next three games. They know exactly what they need to do. I think the pressure is very much on Middlesex. They know Yorkshire's behind them, and they know what Yorkshire are about.
Very much seems that way. And just looking at, and I don't want to jinx this as well, Alan, looking at that three back-to-back county championship wins, I mean, how would that go down in Yorkshire history if they did manage to achieve it?
I think it's always very difficult to compare different teams from different eras, but certainly in the modern era, it's a fantastic achievement, and particularly because of what we said, they've been missing so many key players for so much of the time, and I think that makes it a particularly special thing. And in the modern game, there's so many more demands on the players that I think this would go down as an outstanding achievement, but I wouldn't want to decry the previous teams that have achieved similar feats, because they certainly had great players in their day who achieved great things for Yorkshire.
Alan Birkinshaw there from the Bradford Telegraph and Argus, talking everything cricket there. And it's always good to have a nice little cricket chat. Also this week, though, we're also talking about the future and Future Fest. It's going to be a very interesting one, this one. I'll be joined by Pat Kane from Hue and Cry. Remember, Labour of Love. Yeah, that's the song. I was speaking to him earlier in the week all about the future, and also Josh, who puts on the festival. Absolutely cracking chat. Here it is.
Thanks, Danny, for having us.
First off, I've got to ask about Future Fest, and Josh, I'll start with you on this one. Is it a celebration of what the future might bring, this event?
Yes, it's a two-day festival, and it is a festival in the truest sense. So we have five stages, lots of demos and exhibitions and installations, lots of different touch points for people to interact with future ideas. We also have four themes that guide the event, and they are the future of play, the future of work, thrive, and love.
Absolutely brilliant. Sounds fantastic. And one of the things I've been looking at is on the research into the sort of the meal replacement pill, and it seems like a quarter of people want this. Now, for a man that has to eat his lunch between songs, this seems like the perfect invention for me. I can't believe that one's not more popular.
So it's something I'm personally very interested in. And I actually wrote an article for Nesta as part of our prediction series, which happens at the end of the year every year. And so last December, I wrote an article saying that products like Soylent and Huel, products that are essentially powders that are genetically modified to be the most nutritionally complete thing that you can eat. It's a powder. You shake it up like you would a milkshake and you drink it. And much like having a pill, it's the perfect amount of nutrients and fats and calories and everything. And I personally think that that is an amazing innovation, not only for making, for example, your life easier in terms of eating lunch very quickly, but also people in developing countries where the cost to produce and ship food is very expensive. If we could send them over this pack of nutrition and they could add water to it, I think it would really change the way people are fed.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely fantastic. And something else I have to pick up on, Josh, is the lineup, because you've got the likes of Will Self going down, Rihanna Pratchett. It sounds like it's a real meeting of the minds down there.
It is. So we really pride ourselves in bringing together amazing visionaries, artists, musicians, academics, writers, makers, chefs. We have a huge array. We have over 100 speakers and in 5 stages. So we have a huge array of content and people are constantly talking and debating. And the nice thing about it is we really allow the audience to be involved. So we have a very strong debate program. So we allow the audience to really go deep on these topics and really have their say and shape how the conversations are led.
And Pat, well, I've been doing my research. Of course, you are part of Hue and Cry as well. And I was just wondering, is this something you've always been interested in? How have you made the link to this?
Yeah, good. My brother was reminding me that in 1987, we wrote a song called The Only Thing More Powerful Than the Boss, which was about a computer network that rises up and takes control of a nation. Mm. So, yeah, and ever since then, and I used to read Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein, and I'm a huge SF nerd. There's no way to kind of say this in a modest manner. I'm absolutely nuts about it. So, you know, when Jeff Mulligan, the CEO of Nesta, who's the organisation behind this event, sort of came to me in 2012 and said, "Do you want to do a festival about the future?" I basically just leapt all over him and said, "Yes, yes, yes." So I've had a ball, and one of the things about being a musician is it's quite interesting. One of the things you can say about music in the last 10, 20 years is that digital technology is shaking it left, shaking it right, shaking it up and down, not just in terms of making music, but in terms of the model of music, you know, the business model, the way that, you know, digital content, you know, freed from the price mechanism, you know, completely disrupts everything. All our industries have had to experience what the music industry experienced 10, 20 years ago. So, but it's about a musician is also about connecting passion with technology and also connecting that with audiences. So that's exactly what Future Fest is about. You know, it's about making the future real and tangible for people and giving them an opportunity to be optimistic and can do for a weekend, which in a world which seems to be perpetually beset by problems, large, small, structural, every day, it's actually nice to walk into an optimistic space where people are trying to solve problems and are also trying to think 10, 20, 30 years ahead rather than just, you know, the next quarter or the next 5-year plan or the next week. Human beings are dreamers. That's what we're wired to do. That's why we are top of the tree. So Future Fest is about, actually, it's a very, very human endeavour, I think.
I mean, Pat, you just picked up on it there about how we consume music. It seems a totally different world now from 20 years ago. The fact that vinyl seemed to die, and now it's even being brought back by some people now as well. Do you think that the way that, you know, people like me that are, you know, 20 years old, born in 93, can still sort of know your music later? Do you think that's a good thing, or do you think it's sort of moved away from the consumer?
Well, I think we have Brian Eno as one of our keynote speakers. I mean, you know, Brian Eno has been innovating around about technology and music for, you know, most of his life, you know, all the way from working with Roxy Music and then to Bowie and then to ambient music. And then he's way ahead of everybody even right now. Nobody's really caught up to the fact that he created what he called generative music, which was, you know, computer programs that generate their own musical forms. I mean, and some of them are absolutely beautiful. So, you know, we have Brian there at the peak of the pyramid, as it were, as a speaker, because he's a classic example of a kind of person of the future who's not just interested in technology, but who's interested in creativity and self-expression, and also has a vision for a society that can serve that to the best of its ability. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, arts, Nesta, the original title of Nesta was the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts. And it's always been good. I think one of the reasons why I really enjoy curating for Future Fest is that my mind can roam across anything from, you know, machines that learn better than humans, you know, to, you know, people who make cocktails tailored to your personal biology and biography, you know, and the future has to be fun as well as scary.
It sounds absolutely fantastic. And I also have to pick, I'm going to skip through one bit of research that says almost half of Britons will think radio will be a thing of the past by 2036.
I'll just How wrong past. Are they?
Yeah. I'll skip that for pretty quick. There's another one, that one piece of research that really threw me, and it's that human-machine romances could become a reality. You know, 26% of young people, 18 to 34, will happily date a robot that provided, you know, something of a real-life human being. Now, I don't know if it's just because I've watched Ex Machina, That fantastic film, Dr. Song. Yeah. Fantastic, yeah. Isn't it? I don't know if that's just scared me, but that's one piece of research that just totally thrown me.
So one of our themes at Future Fest is the future of love, and that's actually a topic we're touching on. So the idea of synthetic emotions, so having emotional connections to things that may not be tangible or may not even be human, is something we're really interested in looking at. So we have various experts coming along. Another one of the themes is around identity, so the future of identity. How will people identify themselves in terms of gender, in terms of their personal identity and digital identities? That's something that's definitely coming more and more to the forefront. So, you know, I think young people have a much different attitude towards romance and love and towards technology being integrated in all facets of their lives. They have a much different viewpoint than maybe you or I have.
Well, this sounds absolutely fascinating. Josh, if people want to get a bit more information, want to buy tickets, how could they do that?
So the festival is the 17th and 18th of September. It's at a venue called Tobacco Dock in East London. And the website with tickets and lots of information is futurefest.org.
Oh, that's absolutely fantastic. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you guys today. Thanks a lot for joining us here on the Daytimes.
Thanks, Danny.
Now, as we do every week here on the Daytimes, I always like to have a big argument with Liam Williams from the Mirror Online. It doesn't get much bigger than this week because we were talking about the Manchester City and Manchester United lineups. You know, who would you put in which position from both clubs, you know, an ultimate 11 type thing. You'd think this would take a few minutes and would be pretty much wrapped up. It didn't. It took absolutely forever, and we argued over the minutiae of the formation as well. Today we're going to have a look at what's been happening over in the Manchester derby, because what a weekend of football we've got coming up. And as always, we're going to be previewing it all with the Mirror Online's Liam Williams. Liam, always a pleasure.
It is.
Or sometimes it's a pleasure. Usually. When we're arguing, it's not always a pleasure.
Usually a pleasure.
But we've got to look and start with the Manchester derby. That is within its own fantastic weekend of football. You've got some great derbies coming up this week. You've got the Old Firm derby. Got a couple of other ones in the Championship, like Leeds against Huddersfield. It's going to be an absolute cracker. And there's no reason to move on Saturday.
No, not really. No, apart from it'd be nice if Huddersfield and Leeds were on TV, I think.
That would be great.
It's on radio, though. Here on Radio Yorkshire.
It is Radio Yorkshire. It's there from 1:30 on Saturday. Neil Redfern, Mark Wilson, Andrew Stats Dalton bringing you all the action. But let's look over the Pennines for this one, Liam, because this is probably the first of the battle of the managers that we've seen so far. Guardiola against Mourinho. Have we hyped this up too much? Unless one of them punches another, it's not going to really live up to expectations.
I'm just expecting them to both come out, shake each other's hand, be very pleasant with each other, shake each other's hand after the game, and that'll be it. I don't think there's going to be anything else to it. No. I think it has been, because it's quite well known they don't get along very well, but I think it has been overplayed massively. Mm. There are two teams that are actually going to play, compete for points in the Premier League.
Really?
Title
I thought
race.
They were just going to be on the touchline. We're going to have like a touchline camp.
Yeah, I think there will be. I think you'll spend more time watching the managers than the game.
That wouldn't surprise me, actually. Yeah. I think we should actually create a game on how many times Sky and
drinking
put
game
to Mourinho, Pep Guardiola. Mm. If you want to bring drinking in, Liam, that's fine. I don't mind that at all. But yeah, I mean, as we were saying with other derbies as well, I just want to touch on the Old Firm derby there as well. There hasn't been one in a few years. It's going to be a tasty tie.
I think the last one was October 2012 in the league.
That's impressive knowledge.
And I think the last time Rangers won at Celtic in the league was about April 2010. So you're going back a long time until Rangers have had a league win over Celtic.
It'd be good for Brendan Rodgers as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it'll be. I mean, to be honest, Celtic are probably going to win the league this year.
Probably.
But if they win the league and lost both games to Rangers, I think it'd be tinged.
Yeah, be nothing in it then, would there? Be pointless.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Well, let's look back at the Manchester derby, because there's been quite a lot of talk, quite a lot of hype into it. What do we know injury wise, Liam?
Well, Luke Shaw, he had to leave the England camp. Obviously, broke his leg, as we all know, and he said recently that he still gets sort of aches and pains now and again, which apparently are normal, and he is a doubt for the game. Mkhitaryan left Armenia. He picked up a knock, but he said he should be fit for the game. Other than that, everything looks above board.
And of course, Aguero suspension. Yeah. That's going to play a massive role.
It is. I think that suddenly changes how Guardiola and Mourinho approach the game. I think before that suspension, Mourinho would have been more than happy to take a point. I think they've not taken anything away from us. We'll, you know, we'll be all right with that. We're still level on points with them. Now that Aguero's missing, I think that's an opportunity for United to say, look, we are better than them. We're at home. We're favourites. We've got to go out and do the business.
What would it mean if they actually went out and won that game?
It'd be massive, but, you know, it's 1 of 38 at the end of the day. Both teams going to lose other games. But it's early in the season, it's good to get a marker down. If you think when Man City won 6-1, that was fairly early in the season, and it did put a bit of a marker down. It was like, you know, we're here to stay now, and obviously they went and won the league.
Yeah, no doubt about that. We've been having a look at our first 11s, our ultimate first 11s.
The combined 11, yeah.
Yeah, for this season as well. You know, we're not going to bring in legends or anything like that. I'm not going to go halfway through and bring up Cantona. But what we are looking at in this one is just without any injuries as well or any suspensions. I think that's only fair.
Yeah, just the best 11
we're not,
from
we're not
the
trying
two
to
clubs.
Guess which no, no, no. There because no. We're not managers, so there's be no point. But let's have a look at go through it. Do you want to go first with your goalkeeper there, Lynn?
David De Gea.
Well, I think that's obvious.
Obvious.
Move obvious,
on from
obvious.
That one.
Yep, let's move on because we don't have Joe Hart and Claudio Bravo.
We don't.
Got a patch on him?
No, he doesn't. I don't think many goalkeepers do.
No, I don't either. So let's move on to right back then, Liam.
I've gone with Antonio Valencia simply because
a right back.
He is now.
He isn't. He's
is
a right winger.
No, he isn't.
No, he's a right winger.
He played right back all last season. He's played right back all this season. He played right back the season before that. For all intents and purposes, he's a right back now, and the way he started the season has actually been really impressive. I know a lot of United fans had gone off him because just wasn't contributing to games enough, but all of a sudden he's been one of their best players in every game they've played so far. And I know it's early and you're going on form, but I look at Man City and I think, well, you haven't got a glowing right back like you used to. You go back 12 months, maybe 18 months, it was Pablo Zabaleta, and it has been
for
a while.
I've got Zabaleta.
You've gone with Zabaleta. Yeah. I just think that for the last 12 months and then coming into this season, his form has not been what Antonio Valencia's looks to be.
But he's a right back.
So is Valencia.
I just don't think he is. At the end of the day, he's a winger. He's a winger for the vast amount of his Manchester United career. At the end of the day, he's just a stopgap.
No, but he played at right back a long time ago, just not very regularly. And then as time went on, and I think it was sort of when they signed Juan Mata under David Moyes and thought, well, he'll play on the right for us. We can then play Valencia at right back. They struggled at right back for years of United, but now it looks like they've got somebody who they've converted into a good, dependable right back.
Have you ever had a shelf that's been stayed up with blue tack for a long period of time and it's just kind of there?
No, I've never put a shelf up with blue tack.
Well, essentially, that's Valencia. He's holding up a shelf with blue tack. That is exactly what
it's
he's doing.
Great,
it's a stopgap. And quite frankly, they've not had a good right back since Gary Neville. Okay. So I think Manchester City have to win that
one. So you've gone with Zabaleta?
Yes, I have. You sent back pairing.
This was a bit tough, really, but I've gone with Eric Bailly and Daley Blind. Daley Blind for me is probably the best centre back at both clubs. Eric Bailly, on the other hand, hasn't played very much. We've not seen much of him, but from what I've seen of him, again, he's been better than anyone else I could say for both clubs over the last 12 months.
You see, this is a problem for my centre back pairing, because I put Bailly as you did.
Yeah, and then I just got the player of the month as well for them.
I just put NA.
Because, not applicable.
Because frankly,
so you've just not picked a centre back.
Yeah, I've not picked a centre back.
So we're doing the best 11, and you thought I'll leave the centre back.
Yeah,
right.
Because I don't want to. Because I'd have to put Stones in. It just feels like
would
I'd
you?
Have to put Stones in.
Oh, over Blind.
Yeah.
Why?
I think he's a better player, but I still don't think Stones anywhere near up to that point. I'm not a huge fan of him, to be honest.
You don't like John Stones. You've said that time and time again.
I have. I have no
Blind. Daley Blind is essentially John Stones if he could defend but wasn't as tall.
It's the most ridiculous thing.
They're both very good with the ball, but Blind's a better defender. He's just about 6 inches shorter than him, and probably slower.
I think it doesn't help that. I think if anyone was going to put anyone in there, I'd put Smalling in there.
Stones was going to be Smalling as well. But I just think that
I'll tell you what. If we're going to have to do it, I'm going to force myself.
So you're going to
put
Smalling. The problem is for me, since he got the injury last Christmas, his form's just not been as good as it was. sort of went back to the old Chris Smalling, and now he can't get back in the team.
Well, that's what happens when you give someone your heart last Christmas. But let's move on to left.
You can't
back.
Say last Christmas without hearing it, can you?
You can't. It's immediately sprung up. Yeah. I don't even know what you said in your last sentence. That was just playing over in my mind. Yeah. Let's have a look at left back. Our for Luke Shaw.
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Gotta be.
It's gotta be. And then we get into midfield. This is where it actually starts getting a bit more competitive in my eyes, because as we know, Manchester City haven't had a great defence for quite some time, so we could kind of skip over that. Who do you go for right midfield?
Well, I've sort of gone with five in the middle, if you want. I've done a 4-2-3-1, so I've got two central midfielders.
Let's go with the central midfielders then.
We'll do that.
I thought we'd just go for a plain 4-4-2.
But neither team plays 4-4-2.
Just go for a different form. Go
they
on,
don't
then.
Play 4-4-2.
Centre mid pairing.
Two central midfielders, Paul Pogba, obviously.
Yep,
I've gone with Michael Carrick.
Really?
Yeah.
You're for Michael Carrick?
Yes.
Out of the best two teams in the country, and you've picked Michael Carrick?
Yeah.
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
How is it?
I just don't think he's good enough anymore. I think he's
who have you gone? You've gone with Pogba and who?
I went with Mata in a sort of number 10 role.
He's not, but no. In a number 10 role. It's all falling apart. Yeah, but now you've got, so you've got one central midfielder and then four forwards. No, five forwards, isn't it?
I've got five forwards. I've got 4-4-2.
Right.
I'm just having him playing in behind the strikers.
Right, okay. Well, I've gone with two actual midfield players.
Listen, I'd try to shoehorn these players into some sort of team.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, and so are you anyway.
I'm not.
4-2-3-1.
That is how both teams play. No, that is the formation of both teams.
However you set out a starting formation, you put 4-4-2.
No, you don't.
You do. If you were gonna,
maybe 10 years ago. It's not Mike Bassett years anymore. We've moved on. The game has moved forward.
Just for clarity, I tend to cover a lot of Championship and League One games. Liam doesn't. Yeah, I'm just going to put that out there. Proper football. Anyway, right midfield.
Right winger.
Yeah, right winger, if you want to.
Right winger. I'd gone with Kevin De Bruyne.
Yeah, I would for exactly the same.
I think there's a few players who you could have put there. Yeah, I mean, Henrik Mkhitaryan, if you wanted. Mata plays there for United, but I just think that he's the best of the two teams.
Yeah, no, I totally agree there. I think he's an absolute machine. We agreed on something. How about that for a change? Let's go for left midfield or left wing.
Left wing, yeah.
Martial.
No. David Silva.
Really?
Are you serious?
Yes.
David Silva is considerably better than Anthony Martial is. Considerably.
If I had a football club...
You're not buying players. We're saying who is the best. We're not buying players. We're saying who is the best in that position.
I'm not changing the goalposts. What I'm saying is... Yeah. If I was going to pick two of those players, and they said to me, you can have David Silva or Martial. But for Martial any day of the week.
Why?
Because I think he's got so much more to give. I think he's just a far better fit. He's got so much. If Martial wasn't in the Manchester United team, I think they'd be doing a lot worse right now. And over the last years.
Well, he started the season really poorly. He's been poor in every game he's played. He was poor in every game in the Euros. And to be honest, he tailed off a little bit at the back end of last season, whereas David Silva is just a world-class footballer at the moment. Anthony Martial might be at some point. David Silva right now.
I think he's got it there. I just think
he might be, but David Silva's a better footballer than Anthony Martial.
I don't think he can bring up the Euros. He was shoehorning quite a bit in the Euros. And I don't like bringing that up.
Well, ignore it if you want. Yeah. You don't have to bring it up, but he's just...
Well, you brought it up. I will
discard the Euros then.
Okay, thank
David
you.
David Silva is still considerably better.
Let's move on to your two strikers, Liam, before...
Well, I've gone with a number 10.
Before we run out of time.
I've gone with Juan Mata in the hole.
How many times have you put Juan Mata down?
Once in the hole. You've
Sorry, I thought you put him on the God right. No, you mentioned him and put him on the right, didn't you?
Yeah, I thought I could put him on the right, but De Bruyne I think is better on the right anyway. I'd like to see Silva playing as a number 10, but Silva typically plays out wide anyway, so I've put Mata in there instead. Because again, you could have played other players there. I mean, you've got Wayne Rooney, you could play Mkhitaryan.
You're not
there.
Putting Wayne Rooney anywhere near that.
I haven't, but you could, because that's where he plays at the moment.
I think if it was that, we'd just end this right
Jose
here.
Jose Mourinho, when he picks his team, he puts Wayne Rooney in the hole and puts Juan Mata outside.
I don't care what Jose Mourinho's doing. Sam Allardyce picks Wayne Rooney as well.
Exactly.
So did Roy Hodgson. Did it work out for him?
Well, I think... Well, we know better than them, don't we?
We do, yeah.
Of
course we know better than them. And I'm sure you all do at home as well. And
so, yeah.
If you do argue with any of these, please do get in touch in the comments as well. Let's just go for the...
The other centre-forward was Sergio Aguero.
Yeah, can't argue with that.
Agree with that.
Up front for me, I've got Aguero, Ibrahimovic.
It's a very top-heavy team is yours. Very, very top-heavy.
I'm just saying,
I think
right?
You can
see
too many goals
there.
Players,
you've put Valencia at right-back, and while he's
where
playing
he plays.
There, he's still not a right-back.
Yes, he is. He'll play more games at right back this season than
I
anywhere
imagine
else.
He will, but it's a stopgap.
So, when do we start calling him a right back then? Can we ever call him?
No, we're never calling
right,
him a right back.
He's never going to be a right back. Never. Danny's decided.
No, he's right. never going to be a right back. All right. What have we learned today? That we sort out the formations before we do the actual thing. And don't keep them a total secret from each other. But I hope you've enjoyed our chat anyway. Please do get in touch in the comments. Who do you think will be in there? And who do you think will win?
Liam?
Score?
Before Aguero's suspended, I thought it'd be a draw. Now I'm going 1-0 United.
You see, I always thought it was going to be a Man City win. Now I think it'll be a draw. Score?
1-0.
1-0. I'll go for 1-1.
Okay.
I'll go for a 1-1 there. Yeah.
All right.
I'm looking forward to seeing the results this one.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Oh, good stuff, good stuff. The first thing I want to look at, Ian, is just to start off on your career, because your career, if I'm right, started off in the youth academies over at Leicester City, and I just wanted to know, how much do you think that club's changed since those times?
Well, for a start, going from Filbert Street, which is now a car park, and offices and apartments to the Walker Stadium as it is now, or well, it's not the Walkers, is it? It was the
King Power now.
King
yeah.
Power. It's it's massive changes. A lot of investment, for the better. I think the owners that have come in from Thailand have really put the money where the mouth is. They've made it even more of a family club. So you know, my two oldest girls, I've got four girls. My two oldest ones are season ticket holders. They go down with their granddad every home game, and you know, they've really, you know, pulled the community together, very multicultural, and it's generated a lot of interest. And obviously last year, the culmination of winning the Premier League and Champions League football this year, it's a city that's booming at the moment.
It's absolutely fantastic to hear. And Ian, you started off your career in the early 90s, and that was just before the sort of the influx of money that we saw coming in to the places like the Premier League. And how much do you think football has changed over those years, and what have you made of it?
Well, I think as a footballer, being a footballer, going into Leicester in 1987 and serving an apprenticeship and being on loan at places like Wigan, I mean, that was the old Springfield Park, and it's, you know, it's, obviously, they've moved now, and you see those clubs. A lot of clubs that have invested in new stadia. The money that's sloshing around, certainly at the top end, is in stark contrast to what it was in the early 90s. But players are fitter, stronger, bigger. You know, it's the professionalism in the game in England, with the influx of foreign players, the knowledge of foreign coaches as well, that has helped English coaches and English players to develop as well, and it, you know, it is now for me the best league, or the most watched league in the world, and with the best players and best coaches coming over here.
Yeah, it is absolutely fantastic to see that, Ian. And a lot of the times you hear of Premier League clubs, you know, they talk about maybe a little bit of disconnection between the fans. But the one place where there is maybe a lot more connection is sort of League One and League Two. It seems that the principles of football from some of the early days are very much on show in League One and Two.
Well, certainly the football club that I've come to here at Oldham Athletic is it's a football club that's got to serve the community. It's got to be the shining light. Along with the rugby league, I know that is flying as well. But you know, for us here, we've got to make sure that we put a team out that's hard working, that is in touch with the working man, the person that comes down here and pays the hard earned money. They want to see effort, they want to see drive and commitment from the players and the staff, and that's what we're trying to do here. And likewise, in many, like you say, League One and League Two clubs, that is the case, that that fans ask for that effort to go and watch.
And Ian, we've seen a lot of periods of success over your career as a player and as a manager as well. But what I want to pick up on is Scunthorpe. Is that one of the places where you hold some of your best memories of football?
Well, it certainly is, because you know, I thought I was going there for probably my last contract, my last year of my early 30s, or I was 33 when I went there, and I ended up still playing at 38, 39, and managing to get up from League Two into the Championship. So to have, you know, really great memories from promotion seasons and Championship winning seasons. Then we got relegated from the Championship and then went straight back up via the playoffs. Super memories of a club that is, you know, we've just described the type of, you know, an area that has been hit over the years in industry, and that they want to go and see their football club, you know, put a bit of bit of joy on their face at the weekend, and we managed to do that. So, and it also gave me my first taste of management. It was a difficult period. I knew that, taking over from Nigel. I knew that we, you know, taking over, it would be difficult to stay in the Championship. And at the time, we were still in with a chance of doing that. You know, the night I got the sack, we just dropped into the bottom three, having been beaten by Preston. But we were still in there. But, you know, the powers that be felt that a change was needed. But it taught me a big lesson and has helped me further my career in the coaching management side of it.
I was going to say about that spell at Scunthorpe being the manager. I mean, was it a case while you were playing you always felt you were going to go into coaching and management?
Not while I was always playing, no. It was probably when I was around 26, 27. I was down at, there was Notts County, then I moved to QPR. And I started to look at the younger teams at QPR and the youth team and the underages work with the groups, and I got asked to do a couple of sessions, and you know, it was that really sort of got me into the thinking of the intricacies of coaching and what it means to be on the other side, and I just say took an interest, but wasn't until I came back went to Scunthorpe that I really started doing my badges. Thought while I was still playing, it was a time to go and utilise that that time, and managed to work my way through and. Learned a great deal, still learning, still trying to find bigger and better ways to improve myself as a coach.
And Ian, you just picked up on it about the sacking over at Scunthorpe, and when I've spoken to a lot of people, whether it's been, you know, let go from a big club at sort of youth level or maybe the first sacking in management, big lesson in life. And do you take positives from something like that?
I certainly do. It hardens you. It makes you look at yourself. I've always looked at what I can do better anyway. Certainly, I still do that now as I put sessions on. How can you improve things? How can you be better? How can you deal with matters a little bit easier, if you like? And for me, it was a time to say look at how I dealt with that short period, the 7-8 months, how I dealt with board members, the chairman. It was difficult anyway because I was a player, then went to a coach and a manager. So there was people in the dressing room that I'd actually been sat alongside getting changed next to. And it was a strange feeling to suddenly then be put in those shoes, and how do they sort of deal with me being the one that's making the final decisions. But it was a good grounding for me. And I managed to, you know, utilise that again to take over to my next job in Ireland, and had a really successful period in Sligo. And had 2.5 really successful years.
I was going to say, I watch Irish football. I remember you being in the dugout at Sligo and the success you had. I mean, were you surprised with just how much success you had? Because obviously, you know, winning the league title, winning the FIA Cup as well, it was a fantastic spell for yourself.
Well, it was for a provincial club, and Dundalk are doing that at this moment in time. And they're a provincial club, so a club from outside of the big cities of Dublin and Cork. It's very rare for those clubs to go and have a sustained period of success. I took over after Cookie, who's now at Portsmouth, and he'd had 2 or 3 successful years, but hadn't managed to win the league. And we went over there, probably changed 1 or 2 things, brought 1 or 2 players in, and managed to win the league in that first year, and then you know, to have Champions League experience and Europa League experience, and like you say, win the FAI Cup, and then the following year we won the All Ireland, which was the Setanta Cup that they'd never won in their time. Was an unbelievable period, and for me, really special times again. But you don't rest on your laurels. And 5 weeks after winning that All Ireland trophy, because we were in fifth, that wasn't deemed good enough in the league at the time, and we parted company. So again, a valuable lesson that even when things are going well, you're not too far away from being removed and all change again. So
I mean, as well, when you look at the lure of Irish football in terms of, you know, you've got that prospect of getting into the first qualifying round of the Champions League, things like that, how was it attracting players? Because obviously financially, you know, you're looking at the budgets. Where would you say the budgets are for Irish clubs? Would you say they're ever in the English clubs like a League One level?
No, not at all, no. I would say that we were working on a similar budget to what there would be in several clubs in the conference, and I would say mid to lower conference. Even players from Northern and Southern Conference, you know, you were trying to attract that sort of player because that was the type of money. Plus, you're asking them to come over to the most westerly point of Ireland for me, most westerly point of Europe, in fact, and relocate. So if they've got families, then, you know, you're not too sure about that. The season was a summer season, so again that poses its problems for, you know, the windows that you're working towards. So from March till November is the season time in Ireland. So it took some getting used to, and it took some persuading to get players to come over. But you have to have some good contacts as well that help you do that, and the friendships and contacts I've made through football at times, I tried to utilise them and again managed to bring over players that have gone on and actually come back to English football as well. So again, a real learning curve, and one that I hopefully put into practice later on down the line as I went to Motherwell, and I've now come to Oldham to work with Steve Robinson. It's you're trying to bring together all those skills that you've gone and learnt.
And Ian, I just want to pick up on a club a bit close to us as well in Huddersfield Town. If I'm right in thinking, you did a little bit of scouting there. And of course, Huddersfield now top of the Championship. Only six games in, but still top of the Championship. Did you have a feeling when you were there that this was a club with a good foundation under it, some good stability?
Well, certainly when I went in there and visited the training ground and watched it, a couple of games, I knew that it was a club that has been led very, very well from the top right the way through. I had most of my dealings with Ross Wilson, who's now moved on to Southampton. He's the director of football and recruitment. Chris Powell, who I knew, through the times of playing and when he was at Leicester, and tried to help as much as I could. But certainly the infrastructure that had been put in place there, its foundations are solid, and it's now enabling it hopefully to go from strength to strength. And who knows? After a successful year, maybe, that started very, very well this year, why not be in the Premier League?
It certainly will be exciting to see that, Ian. And one other thing I had to pick up on as well is, obviously, this year you were appointed as the assistant manager over at Oldham, and it wasn't with too much time left to the start of the season. What was it like in the pre-sort of season and sort of getting things as a foundation for Oldham?
Well, it was... it's been a whirlwind, 10 or 11 weeks now. We took over in the first week of pre-season. There was seven contracted players, of which three or four of those were 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds. We quickly had to try and get together a group through trialists, through, again, contacts and the links you make with the agents and coaches of players that are out of contract or looking to move on. And we still had trialists coming in the final week of pre-season, which wasn't ideal, but it was what it was, and our first competitive game against Millwall away was a baptism of fire, really. It came too early for us, but we've worked on trying to be a solid unit, a hard-working unit, a team throughout that works for each other and doesn't give a great deal away. And then, the more we can add up top and the more we can work on the aspects of going forward, hopefully it'll come together. But it won't be easy, we know. We're competing against some bigger clubs with bigger budgets, and it's a challenge, but one I'm thoroughly enjoying and relishing.
Looking for more of a long-term plan for Oldham, then?
Well, it is. I think whenever a manager goes in, you know that it's... can you ever look long-term? But we're trying to put things in place here that are going to really see the club do well in the long run. Whether we're here to be able to see that through, who knows? Again, that's in the hands of other people. So you can only do as well as you can. But we've put together a squad that we'll try to add to in the windows that are coming up if you're given that time, and hopefully we can improve on what has been around the last few years, 4 or 5 years they finished in 15th or below. We're trying to get this club into a mid-table sort of top 10 finish, and that would be progress at this moment in time. So again, without getting too far ahead of ourselves, It's a case of trying to improve as you go along, little by bit, bit by bit.
It certainly will be fantastic to see. And just finally as well, just want to pick up on League One as a competition, because some people say that, you know, League One is a very, very competitive league. It seems that more than ever this season. Yeah. What do you make of the competition overall in League One?
Well, I watched a lot of it last year, because when I got moved on from Motherwell, I then worked for Doncaster with Darren Ferguson, scouting, helping out, watching players and watching games for him. So you know, I came into this job with a good bit of knowledge about League One and the clubs that were and players that were in it. And again, there wasn't a great deal between any side last year. I think Wigan came through towards the end, well, in the second half of the season, to be very strong. But apart from that, you know, there wasn't any real standout teams, and everyone could beat anybody. And it just proved to me and Stephen, having come into the job as well, that you know, if you do get a group that are willing to put in the hard graft, that you can. You can go a long way, and you know, we're trying to again increase the togetherness amongst the whole club, so that as a community, as a club, we can move on as a group.
It certainly sounds fantastic, Ian. I'm looking forward to the rest of the League One season. Wishing you all the best of luck over there as well, Ian. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for taking the time out and joining us here on Daytimes today. Lastly as well, before we wrap up the Daytimes podcast here, it feels only right to hear from Ian Barraclough, the Oldham assistant manager. Had him on Monday's show. Really interesting chat about his career. It doesn't get much better than the chat we had there. Really lovely guy. I really do thank you for taking the time out to speak to us. And here is the chat with me and Ian. So that's all good time for you on the Daytimes podcast. Thanks a lot for joining us throughout the week. And if you missed any of it, remember to check out Audioboom channel, audioboom.com/Radio Yorkshire. And you can hear me live every weekday from 11 till 2 with some cracking tunes and some cracking guests. And it's all a good bit of fun as well. So thanks a lot for listening, and I'll see you next week.